You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
As the latest greatest election in the world rolls along, we have now completed 5 of the 7 phases, I think. We're almost at the playoff stage where teams will get... Wait, that's the IPL. Honestly, they've both been going on for so long, I've kind of lost track. But here we are, the 2019 election. Protracted as it is, this year's election allows us the opportunity to examine our political landscape in a bit more detail. And that is what we've been doing for the past few weeks. On today's episode of Decoding 2019, we will examine the role of half the population, the role that women are expected to play in this year's Lok Sabha elections as voters and as leaders. My name is Rakesh Sharma, and this is Money Control.
The Deep Dive podcast series. Women are voting more than ever, but why don't we have more women MPs?
In recent times, we might recall that meeting when the United States and India met at their inaugural 2+2 summit just last September in 2018. The world media was agog that the most powerful country in the world had sent 2 male members, Defense Secretary James Mattis and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and receiving them on the other end in India were Minister of External Affairs Sushma Swaraj and Defense Minister Nirmala Sitharaman. Now, 2 extremely powerful women in extremely powerful cabinet positions facing off against these 2 men from the United States, arguably the most powerful country in the world. Now, this might have lulled us into thinking that powerful women in India are the norm. Women candidates and women politicians are the norm and they're rising. Now, if we thought that, yes, it is certainly true compared to, well, 1952, but in the overall grand scheme, not necessarily. We've had our fair share of powerful women. Indira Gandhi, the daughter of the first Prime Minister. In recent times, we've had Mayawati, Mamata Banerjee, and Jayalalitha down in the south, etc. But these have tended to be more the exception than the norm. Now, despite these several high-profile examples, the role of women in contemporary Indian politics is far more complex and, unfortunately, much less represented. In most states, these days, female turnout is in fact surpassing that of male turnout. It wasn't the case in the 2014 national elections, but in the assembly elections that took place in 2017, 2018, etc., female turnout was slightly more than the male turnout, which is certainly an impressive thing. And the other interesting thing is they don't vote according to the whims of their men. Women have tended to vote in ways they see fit for themselves. This is what we'll try and understand: the rise of the woman voter and the plight of the woman politician. Okay, I will admit that the phrase women voters is more than a little ungainly, because women don't vote en masse. They're not like one thinking monolith who all vote the same way. That is absolutely not true. In fact, they average over 65% in voting percentage for parliamentary elections compared to 67% for men. This was the latest. That is the 2014 data. Almost neck and neck there, and one hopes that it is in fact equal this time, if not more. If the recurring promises by politicians to declare prohibition in their states are any indication, women voters are even addressed directly by leaders across the spectrum as if they were a single monolith. One gentleman by the name of Nitish Kumar did that not so long ago. What I'm getting at is women tend to vote differently than men. And in 2019, estimates claim that around 430 million women are eligible to vote in India. Women voters have, of course, over the years, taken an increasingly active part in the electoral process. Women in India were granted voting rights in 1950, as we know, by universal suffrage, which is enshrined in Article 326 of the Indian Constitution. Now, it is remarkable when you think that in the United States, that happened just 30 years before that, in 1920, after a gap of 113 years when suffrage was granted to other citizens. Given the literacy levels in India in the 50s and 60s, like we spoke about it yesterday, when the first general election happened, the literacy rate was about 15%. It shouldn't come as a surprise that there was a big gap in the 50s and 60s when it came to voting. Men tended to vote more than the women. One Times of India report claimed that the gap in turnout between men and women was 16.7% in 1962, but that gap fell to around 4.4% in 2009 and just 1.79% in the 2014 Lok Sabha polls. According to the book, The Verdict, which is written by India's veteran news anchor and head of NDTV, Dr. Pranoy Roy, along with election researcher Dorab Soparivala, I quote from that book, in 1962, women's turnout was about 15% lower than the men's turnout. But by 2014, women's turnout had almost reached parity with men, short by only about 1.5 to 1.79%. In a rough estimate, if earlier it was 3 women to every 10 male voters, now the numbers are up to 7 women voters for every 10 men. Now, that extraordinary progress notwithstanding, Roy and Soparivala speculate that 21 million women did not get to vote in 2014 because they were not registered. Which reminds me of the story of the first general election when about 2.8 million women did not end up voting in the general election because Sukumar Sen, the first election commissioner, had insisted that women identify themselves by their own name on the electoral rolls as opposed to how it used to be in conservative families where they would go A's mother or B's wife, Ramu ki ma, Lakshman ki biwi or Chandu ki ma, etc., etc. Now, he didn't want that. He wanted their names to be registered on the rolls. And when that did not happen, as it happened, about 2.8 million women did not get to vote. But cut to 2014, 21 million women did not get to vote because they were not registered. They said, that is Roy and Soparivala, said Jammu and Kashmir, Madhya Pradesh, Uttar Pradesh and Bihar ranked the worst in terms of women turnout, while West Bengal, Assam and Odisha were among the best, as were smaller regions in Lakshadweep, Nagaland and Dadra and Nagar Haveli. An analysis on Scroll put forward an interesting conjecture, which is perhaps not unfounded. The Scroll article went on to say, there are a variety of reasons for women going out and exercising their franchise in bigger numbers than ever before. Political fortunes can swing on the basis of just a single percentage point increase in vote share. That appears to have encouraged parties to focus more specifically on appealing to women voters and ensuring they make their way to the polling stations. Unquote. That analysis claims that in 2019, India's female voting age population is expected to be around 97.2% of the total male population. Now, if there are 100 eligible male voters, there are about 97 female voters to those 100. One would expect the same proportion for voters, except women voters are just 92.7% of the male electorate, which is a 4.5% shortfall, or the number that I said earlier, 21 million people. Where did these women go? Roy and Soparivala's book claims that the 21 million number is equivalent to every single woman in any of the states, like Jharkhand, Haryana, Telangana, Kerala, or Chhattisgarh, not being allowed to vote at all. That is hyperbole, but the NDTV analysts went on to claim, and I quote, and this is significant to understand, where are these women? They said, 21 million missing women translates to 38,000 missing women voters in every constituency in India on average. So, 21 million divided by the 543 seats in the country. The kicker really is there are a large number of Lok Sabha constituencies, one in every five, that is a fifth of the total Lok Sabha seats, where victory or loss means a margin of less than 38,000 votes. Now, it's important to remember that these 21 million female voters that have gone missing could, if franchised, result in either victory or loss one way or the other. The question we need to ask ourselves is, where are these missing women? According to Business Insider, the proportion of women who stepped out to vote surpassed that of the men in the assembly elections held in 2017 and 2018. Like I said earlier, it was as high as 70% for women in the last 2 years, compared to 43% among men. Now, that data set addresses the 6 states that went to the polls in the last 2 years: Gujarat, Karnataka, Madhya Pradesh, Punjab, Rajasthan, and Uttar Pradesh. In fact, several districts in Tamil Nadu, Nagaland, and Sikkim have closed the gender gap, and in some of them, more women are voting than men. In the 2017 Uttar Pradesh Assembly poll, women voters outnumbered their male counterparts. About 63.26% of women voters in the politically extremely crucial state went to the polling booths, as against 59.43% of the men. In Karnataka, the number of women voters increased by 13% following the revision of electoral rolls in 2018. In Kerala, women voters outnumber the men, and no political party can afford to ignore their preferences. All political parties are paying attention to this change on the ground. From Modi to Rahul Gandhi to Nitish Kumar to any of the southern parties that are not BJP or Congress, they have all made women issues one of the more central issues in their campaigns this time around. If in 2014, Modi's chant or claim to want to come to power was economic growth and development, this time there has been a clear pivot towards social issues, most importantly, women's issues. In one of his campaign trails, he had said for us, whether it is the organization or the government or framing of programs, it is women first. In fact, in another appearance, he had gone to great lengths to speak about how when we empower the women in a family, we empower the entire household. And it is in this regard that many of his signature campaigns, like Swachh Bharat or Ayushman Bharat, or indeed Ujwala, which is furnishing cooking gas cylinders to millions of poor households, have been directed toward. And some people would even argue that the ban of the practice of triple talaq was also a move in this direction to protect the constitutional rights of Muslim women across India. But there are, of course, other commentators who might argue that there might be more nefarious reasons at work. But having said that, the importance of women as a vote bank is now being realized increasingly by most of the parties. It's a similar story with Rahul Gandhi as well. We do know for a fact that in the Congress manifesto, there is a resolution to finally pass a women's reservation bill, which is a legislative act which would reserve 33% of all seats in the Lok Sabha and state assemblies for women. In fact, under the 73rd Amendment to the Indian Constitution, which was passed way back in 1993, 26 years ago, at least one third of local village council president positions must be reserved for women. Has that happened? No. But there is a growing urgency to address this issue. The Women's Reservation Bill, for example, was introduced in 1996. It was even passed by the Rajya Sabha and has remained stalled in the Lok Sabha. Now, the UPA, in fact, had tabled the bill in Rajya Sabha in 2008. It was then referred to a standing committee. It was then helmed by Congress member Jayanti Natarajan. The committee comprised 30 members from both the houses of the parliament, but only five of them were women. The committee supported the bill, although two of its members from Samajwadi Party, Virendra Bhatia and Shailendra Kumar, moved a dissent note. They said, we should only have 20% reservation and not 33%. The bill was eventually passed in the Rajya Sabha, like I said earlier, on the 9th of March 2010. Versions of this bill have in fact been introduced in 1996, 1998, 1999, but all three bills lapsed with the dissolution of the Lok Sabhas during those times. Several regional parties have been equivocal at best about their commitment to this women's reservation bill, or the Rangarajan amendment as it is known. The southern parties like the TDP and the AIADMK seem insincere in their commitment to women's reservation. SP, RJD and JDU have also staunchly opposed the bill at one point or another. At best, they have been equivocal. Take the example of JDU, for example, which is now part of the BJP-led NDA. They have 8 parliamentarians across the Rajya Sabha and the Lok Sabha, and there is only one woman. Last year, all of its members in the Rajya Sabha, including the lone woman, that is Kekasha Parveen, a woman, voted against Rangarajan's amendment, that is, the Women's Reservation Bill. So, there hasn't really been, historically speaking, much sincerity or commitment from the major political parties about the Women's Reservation Bill. The strongest hint of one party taking a stand we have seen is the Congress in their manifesto, promising to get the Women's Reservation Bill enacted. But like I said, the winds are changing a little bit. The opposition is not as staunch as it used to be, and parties are coming to understand that there is this large voting block. They might not all vote similarly, but they vote. That's the point. Is an important one in the elections. So the parties are tweaking their political messaging campaign strategies to appeal to women voters, since there is enough evidence to suggest that women can swing elections. India Today claimed that in December 2018, the Congress carried out a survey of approximately 40,000 women in Karoli in Rajasthan to understand how they vote. The survey asked about their access to information, political choices, meaning were they different from that of their husbands or brothers or fathers or, like, you know, influential male members in the family. The findings of that survey, as India Today pointed out, were striking. Nearly 75% of the respondents said they get information independently of the men and are independent in their political choices, a near complete reversal of their responses after the 2008 assembly elections, when most of them said they voted for whoever the family voted. Karoli, incidentally, in Rajasthan, has a lower literacy rate than the national average and is classified as an underdeveloped district. So it should tell any political party which assumes women vote exactly the way their men vote, that's simply not true. Milan Vaishnav, who's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, whose research is mostly on the political economy of India, believes that this moment belongs to the ladies. He said, and I quote, "For the first time in history, we are seeing the gender gap close. Women are coming out to exercise their franchise, which makes them swing voters. These are people you can convince to join your side. We've seen it in 2014, in places where women's turnout increased, the BJP benefited more." Pranoy Roy and Soparivala claimed that the BJP-led NDA had a lead of 9% among women voters, compared to a lead of 19% among men. The analysis in India Today claimed that women vote on very different issues compared to men. While more men are likely to vote along the lines of caste, religion, nationalism, and identity, women are more likely to focus on economic issues which have a direct bearing on the quality of their life. Like that once wise man said, listen to the woman and you know exactly what the country wants. A Congress Party analyst observed that for the female voter, it is about the present and the future, while for the male voter, it is about identity. Women are likely to vote over job opportunities for themselves or their children, as well as safety and security. Politicians, like I said, are paying close attention. Their eye shayad durust bhi aa jaye. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in a speech, said recently, "Our country is moving from women's development to women-led development." Interim Finance Minister Piyush Goyal said, "I want to give 10 crore toilets to my sisters and mothers so that they get dignity of life. That program cannot wait, even if it means I have to borrow a little more." Now, platitudes aside, as per an analysis by India Today, the importance of the Indian woman voter is reflected in the political rhetoric across parties. Prime Minister Modi's flagship schemes, whether it be Ujjwala or the sanitation campaign of building toilets or prioritizing Asha, which is centered around maternal health, are all focused on women as key beneficiaries. Politicians are also extolling the virtues of women as better money managers and homemakers, unquote. Now, as I told you earlier, women are more likely to focus on economic issues. The opposition, like I said earlier, is not far behind. The India Today piece also noted that the Congress president has made a fervent poll pitch saying if voted to power, his party would ensure the passage of the Women's Reservation Bill. Bringing Priyanka Gandhi to a crucial strategic position in the party is also a move directly to reach out to women voters, unquote. Praveen Chakravarti, chairman, data analytics department of the Congress Party, explained that the old concept of a household vote is all but gone. He said, and I quote, "I think in a household now, there could be four different votes. The year 2019 will be an information election. There's been a dramatic change in the way political parties are viewing this election. In my own family, I can tell you for a fact, in 2009, when the four of us in the family voted, there were three different parties that got our vote. And in 2019, when we voted, my mom and dad voted for a party. You might guess who that might be. I voted for a different party. So that household vote, I mean, as the family goes, so the votes of all the family members do, is a long gone thing. Much of this change is owed to the increasing ease of access to information. Now, take a dump all you want on social media and your Facebooks and the WhatsApps, etc. Sure, there's plenty of fake news, but it has also made access easier to accurate information. It is rare, few and far between, I understand, but it is out there. While we wince over what our mothers and fathers receive and forward on WhatsApp, horrific, cannot even begin to tell you the horrors of it. The fact is that with over a billion mobile connections cutting across social sectors, access to information has become easier than ever before. And Indian women are consuming it fervently. Shamika Ravi, who is the director of research at Brookings India, cited a study she conducted on Bihar's two assembly elections in 2005. With no clear winner in February, president's rule was declared, as we remember, with re-elections 8 months later in October-November. Her comparative analysis of electoral outcomes for the 243 constituencies in Bihar showed that the winning party changed in 87 constituencies, meaning 36% of the previous winners in the February election were voted out in the October-November election. Now, how did she explain this? She explained it like this, and I quote, That brought an end to the RJD rule of 15 years and led to the emergence of JDU as the single largest party. There were no new policies in these 8 months. The explanation for the change result was the voter turnout of women in Bihar. More women came out and voted against the previous winners the second time. They wiped out a third of the previous winners. The beneficiary of that increased turnout by women voters, the current Chief Minister Nitish Kumar, paid heed to the winds of change in his state. Ever since, many of his programs, from the bicycle scheme to the liquor prohibition in the state, all seem to suggest that he recognizes the power of those voters. There's another interesting observation that Shamika Ravi made, which I must talk about here. She explains that the results of her study, the Bihar election study in 2005, indicated that a spurt in female voter turnout reduced the re-election chances of a party, while the rise in the number of male voters improved it. So when women exercise their vote independently, they show that their interests are distinct from the other half of the society. So like I said earlier, the concept of the household vote or the concept of the female vote turning exactly like the household's dominant male members would be are concepts that are no longer valid. Now, we've spoken about the female voter. Let's speak about women and political leadership now. How many women are there in the upper echelons of political decision-making in this country? Women, as we've established, who vote for different reasons, require representatives who reflect their own ideas and aspirations. But that change, unfortunately, has been slow to come about. The current union cabinet, 9 women ministers, which is still the most in independent India's history, but that is not a huge number by any stretch of the imagination. A recent analysis by Narayan Ramachandran of Include Labs on Mint explained that India ranks 153rd out of 190 nations in the percentage of women in the lower house of world parliaments. India had 65 women out of 545 members of Parliament elected to the 16th Lok Sabha in May 2014, meaning 12% representation. That is not impressive. According to a list compiled by the Inter-Parliamentary Union, Rwanda ranks first, with 61% of its lower house representatives being women. Now, the understanding of Africa with its backwardness might not have as many women is completely shattered. That is 61% in Rwanda. Nordic countries as a region are the leaders, of course, in this regard as well, with an average of about 40%. We keep harping on about how America hasn't had a female president when, in fact, India had a female prime minister way back in the 1960s. Now, this is a case of interesting moral licensing. So we've elected a woman prime minister. That must mean we are not sexist. That must mean women have the same importance as men do. This is a concept called moral licensing. I have one black friend, so it must mean I'm not a racist. Most recently employed by Donald Trump, there was a house hearing going on and a black woman who happens to be a friend of the family was brought in as a prop. And one of those congressmen defending Donald Trump said, "Look at this black woman. She is friends with the Trumps, so that must mean Trump is not a racist." Which is completely wrong because the man is a racist. So we engage in a lot of this moral licensing. But when it comes to actual facts, the representation of women in the lower house of the parliament is still minuscule, 12%. The UK and the US are also laggards, 32% in the UK and 23% respectively. Pakistan, with 20% participation from women, is also, by the way, ahead of India. Prior to the 15th Lok Sabha, the number was stagnant at 9% for decades. But the tide, fortunately, is turning, but unfortunately, turning slowly. Women now account for 46% of elected representatives at the various levels of Panchayati Raj institutions, according to the Ministry of Panchayati Raj. Bidyut Mohanty, who heads the Women's Studies Division at Delhi-based Institution of Social Sciences, told Scroll, and I quote, "Nearly a million women have gone through the panchayat system as elected leaders, and another 2 million have contested the elections and lost. They are very aware voters, aware of development and other issues of their villages." Unquote. The change at the grassroots is heading upwards as well, but unfortunately, again, as I keep repeating, slowly. There are two political parties which are making a difference. Naveen Patnaik's Biju Janata Dal in Odisha and Mamata Banerjee's Trinamool Congress in West Bengal. They announced that they will be fielding a significant number of women for the 2019 elections. That is, of course, a welcome change in a country where women comprise 48.1% of the population but hold only 12% of Lok Sabha seats. Biju Patnaik famously announced he will earmark 33% or 7 out of 21 of the BJD's parliamentary election tickets for women. As of now, only 3 out of the 21 MPs representing Odisha are women. In the 147-strong state assembly, women account for just 8% of all legislators, less than the national average of 9%. Now, another surprise comes here, which is Haryana. Haryana, as we know, has high levels of female feticide, and the sex ratio there is bewildering, as we all know this. But it has the highest proportion of women MLAs at 15% of the total assembly strength. In Kerala, women's representation peaked at 9.3% in the 2001 election, but has steadfastly remained below 6% ever since. Now, what might explain this? Economists Mudit Kapoor and Shamika Ravi have come up with an explanation. They hypothesize that this rather counterintuitive result is a product of social stratification. They say that in states where women enjoy greater equality, in this case Kerala for example, they may not feel compelled to throw their hats into the ring as candidates and assume the financial burdens of campaigning. Meanwhile, in states where women feel underrepresented, be it Haryana or Uttar Pradesh, getting actively involved in politics may represent an important route for making their voices heard. Now, that might explain how Haryana has a higher proportion of women MLAs, 15% of the total assembly strength, in comparison to the most literate state of the country, Kerala, with 6%. In Odisha's neighboring state, West Bengal, TMC's firebrand chief Mamata Banerjee released a list of party candidates to parliament for 2019. Of these, 41% are women, which is unprecedented for any election ever in the history of Indian democracy. Now, that is something to cheer. Moonmoon Sen also happens to be one of them, but it is still a victory that 41% of the women announced for the parliamentary elections by one party happen to be women. In fact, women's voter turnout in Bengal exceeded that of the men even in the 2011 assembly election, the election which saw Mamata Banerjee's Trinamool Congress end 34 years of uninterrupted Marxist rule in a communist bastion. So women are making a huge difference in the electoral politics of West Bengal. Scroll noted that in the next assembly election, while women's voter turnout remained higher than that of men, more women also contested the election as candidates. The results were proof that Mamata's popularity was unparalleled in Bengal. The CPIM was relegated to number 3 in the state, while the BJP emerged as the principal opposition, signaling a new era altogether in West Bengal's politics. But these were the stories of two regional parties, Biju Janata Dal and Trinamool Congress. What is it at the national party level? They are yet to fully throw their weight behind this change. Of the 184 candidates announced in the first list by the BJP, only 23 were women, making that 12.5%. On the Congress's list, 17 out of the 143 candidates, that is even less than 12.5, 11.9% were women. Shaina NC, party spokesperson and treasurer of the Maharashtra BJP, has been vocal about her disappointment with this state of affairs. She said, and I quote, "The BJP has already earmarked 33% to women within the organization, but that is not sufficient. Fighting elections is most important." She also went on to tweet, and I quote, "Upset and appalled to know that other than Mamata Banerjee and Naveen Patnaik, all other parties only pay lip service to our cause. What is worrisome is that we're still having dialogues and discussions on the most basic rights that any human being should be entitled to. That's why a 33% reservation must be a collective, concerted, conscious effort of all women in public life. Here on, I will champion the cause of reservation even if I have to fight the male chauvinistic mindset in my party and in all other parties as well." Now, that's rather brave, I have to say. There's another aspect of intersectionality that we have to consider here. Women are much more likely to run for parliamentary seats reserved for SC-ST candidates than in general races. Why is that? According to Francesca Jensenius, who is a political scientist, most parties tend to view male politicians in caste and tribal dedicated seats as more dispensable than other male office holders. In a sense, parties often reproduce, she says, the hierarchical pathologies of the caste system even within their own party structure. So many political parties, she says, seem to have chosen the path of least resistance, improving women's representation by replacing their least powerful men. There is also an interesting analysis which looked at affidavits submitted by candidates contesting in India's 2004 and 2009 parliamentary elections. It showed that the median wealth of male candidates is three times that of their female counterparts. Milan Vaishnav spins it like this: if the costs of campaigning are lower in reserved areas that are reserved for SC/ST candidates, poorer candidates would stand a greater chance of winning. So when parties field women in reserved seats, are women likely to win more in those reserved seats than they are in the general races? It appears they might be. Since 1980, 16.2% of female candidates in reserved seats have emerged victorious, while only 11.5% of women running for unreserved general seats have won. So while women are turning out more and more at the polls and contesting in elections more than before, it is still a sorry state of affairs when it comes to the top. And that obviously needs to change sooner rather than later. That said, let's not also forget that this is the year Priyanka Gandhi Vadra enters the fray as a game changer. How much game she has changed, we don't know yet. And of course, Smriti Irani, some people say, is expected to upset Rahul Gandhi in the constituency of Amethi. The final word on this subject goes to the rather trenchant analysis by India Today, which said, and I quote, "The 2019 election promises to be one in which the rules of engagement will change further, as will the political discourse. As women come out in greater numbers, they will seek more accountability and are more likely to vote for development than caste and identity. If that happens, the country will be so much the better for it," unquote. So women vote differently. But more women also need to represent these different ideas in positions of power. And here is hoping, here is fervently hoping that that happens. Do write into us, mcpodcast@nw18.com. Until the next time you hear from me, this is me, Rakesh Sharma, on behalf of the Money Control Podcast Desk, saying thank you for joining us and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast. And you have been listening to Money Control.